ஓம் ராமாய ராமபத்ராய ராமச்சந்திராய வேதசி ரகுநாதாய நாதாய சீதாய பதே நமஹ. சாப்டர் 1 ஆஃப் பாலகாந்த் இஸ் ஆல்சோ நோன் ஆஸ் அ சம்மரி சாப்டர். இஸ் அ கான்வர்சேஷன் பிட்வீன் வால்மீகி அண்ட் நாரத். தி ரெசிடேஷன் ஆஃப் சாப்டர் 1 பாலகாந்த் பிகின்ஸ். Long ago in Treta Yuga, there lived a sage by the name Valmiki. His knowledge of the Vedas and the Vedangas was deep and profound. He had trod the fourfold path that leads to liberation and discharged the duties of his place in life to their utmost. He had the fleeting senses under perfect control and the mind their monarch. And unto him in his holy hermitage came Narada one fine morning. Narada, the divine sage, Narada, the best and foremost of the mind-born sons of Brahma. His long life had been spent in unselfish prayer and devout meditation. The bonds of karma and material existence were to him a thing of the past. He knew no other joy than to contemplate the countless perfections of the Lord of all, and the deeper mysteries of the holy Vedas. And from his Veena Mahati, he drew forth such strains as held enthrall the hearts of all gods and men, to the accompaniment of which he sang the praises and the glory of the Great Father, as embodied in the hymns of the Samaveda. Very few equals had he in the art of speech, so clever and so convincing was he. And to him who came there, impelled by the searcher of hearts, Valmiki respectfully submitted the following questions. Among men in the world, who is one crowned with every excellent quality? Who has mastered the science of weapons, human and divine? And out of the might engendered thereby, is able to scatter his foes before him? Who is versed in the mysteries of Dharma as revealed in the Vedas and the Smritis? Who is it that bears not in mind the grievous wrongs done to him by others, but magnifies any single act of kindness on their part? Who is it whose thoughts, deeds, and words are ever in perfect harmony? Who never strays from his Dharma even in the face of direst peril and distress? Whose life is pure and spotless? Who ever seeks the highest good of humanity and of himself here and hereafter? Whose eyes see clearly and unerringly between the real and the unreal? Who has a profound knowledge of men and things and twines himself round the hearts of all? Who is a perennial source of delight to all that approach him? Who, like a skillful driver, has his mind and senses under perfect control? Who is it that allows not his temper to get the upper hand of him? Who is it of presence so charming that men can never have enough of beholding him? Whose heart knows not envy, spite, and calumny? Who is it that men and gods dare not face when the fierce joy of battle is on him? Verily, it is almost hopeless to find all these noble elements combined in one single individual. But if there be such a one, you would know it of all men, for reverend sir, there is nothing either in the heavens above or in the worlds below that escapes your all-seeing eye. And nothing would gladden my heart so much as to hear it from your lips, if you but deem me worthy of the honor. He paused for a reply, and Narada rejoiced at having at last gotten opportunity for giving out to the world what he had all along lain next to his heart and had been the subject of his thoughts, waking or sleeping. Lo! Here was a disciple after his own heart, who thirsted for the very knowledge he was seeking to impart. What more could he desire? And then the questions! How clear and how comprehensive. So with a glad heart he spoke back. Well hast thou questioned and skillfully. Of a truth it is not easy to find one in whom all these diverse excellences are united. But with a little thought, I believe I can find you a person answering to your description. Verily, no one has better right to know it, for your keen and clear intellect is equaled but by your powerful memory. And now listen with your heart and soul. There now rules the earth a king by the name Rama, for the godly line of Ikshvakus, and in him will you find your expectations fall very short of the reality. He has his self under perfect control. His prowess is unequaled. The splendor of his presence baffles description. He is serene alike in weal and woe. His intellect is strong, keen, and comprehensive. There is very little that he does not know about kingcraft. His sweet speech charms away the hearts of men. You can never have enough of looking at him. So lovely a sight is he to see. Enemies he has none, neither in the world or in himself. Broad are his shoulders and mighty. His arms are stout and strong. His neck is poised on his shoulders with perfect grace, and the three lions around it make it charming to behold. His massive jaws are but an index to the iron will of the man. His broad chest and deep flanks bespeak a strength that could lightly take up a bow and string it, that others would never even dream of approaching. His joints are strong and supple and deeply embedded in muscle. His friends and followers may well bid defiance to their foes, be they ever so mighty. His hands are long and powerful and reach down below his knees. His head is exquisitely modeled and his forehead beautifully arched like a crescent. Graceful and majestic is his gait, even as that of the lion or elephant or the tiger. Neither too short nor too tall, his stature becomes him marvelously. His limbs are clean made and beautifully proportioned, and his rich complexion speaks of the perfect health of the man. It requires but a simple effort of his will to destroy his enemy's root and branch. His eyes are large and lustrous, even as the petals of the lovely lotus, rich in all the things of the world that make a man happy. He is, in short, the beau ideal of man. The weak and the oppressed find in him a ready and fearless champion. He never makes a resolve, but it is accomplished to the utmost. He is ever intent upon the highest good of all beings. Bright is his fame as a refuge of the stricken and the terror of his foes, even as the sun in his noonday splendor. Ever engaged in the meditation on the Supreme, he has realized his oneness with it. Untouched by desire and by hate, with his system purified by the regulation of the vital currents and the other yogic practices, and with a body which, though real and substantial to all purposes, is but an illusion and is formed out of a film of inconceivably subtle matter, he is ever pure of body, pure of heart, and pure of spirit. He is always obedient and dutiful to his parents, his teachers, and to the gods, but he forgets not even for a moment who he is and why he has come down here. He looks after the welfare of his subjects even as the great patriarch Brahma. Of every kind of wealth he has enough and to spare. In him the worlds live and move and have their being. Unlike other rulers of men, he reads into the hearts of his subjects and realizes for them their unspoken wishes even beyond the wildest expectations. He has a watchful eye on the rights and duties of all grades of society and sees that they are carefully preserved and properly discharged. To him, he is the strictest of taskmakers and his daily life is but a silent example and unspoken lesson to the world in his perfect discharge of the manifold and complicated round of duties. Ever the spear and shield of his friends and followers, his heart seeks their highest good here and hereafter. The heart doctrine of the Vedas and the Vedangas lies open before his unclouded vision. He is a past master in the science and art of warfare, and in the use and mastery of weapons, human and divine. No arts or sciences lay or otherwise have any secrets from him. His memory is something marvelous. In argument, he is ever clear and convincing, keen and thorough in his grasp of a subject, quick and ready in his replies, anticipating the slightest objections and difficulties of his opponents. One has but to come within the range of his benign glance, nay, to seek him in earnest thought, to have his heart wishes realized to the utmost in this world or the next. His manners are sweet and refined. The waves of adversity beat against him but to roll back baffled and broken. He is ever wise and skillful in his relations with the world, lay and religious. As the rivers of the world, large and small, ever flow back to their heart and source, the mighty ocean, and take rest and refuge in it, so the wisest and the best of the land are ever attracted to him by similarity of tastes and pursuits and by an irresistible charm of manner. He embodies in himself whatever is highest and noblest in the Aryan race and nation. He is just and impartial in his dealings with all, friends and foes, and his heart is like the calm waters of the mountain lake, unruffled by the last breath of joy and sorrow. You may look at him ever so often, but every time you find in him something that surprises you, a new beauty, a new grace, a new charm. Said I not that Rama, the pride and joy of his mother Kaushalya, unites in himself every conceivable perfection? Deep and unfathomable of purpose, like the vast and mighty ocean, whose unknown waters hide from human eyes many a marvel and many a secret, strong in his resolve and unshaken, even as the mighty Himalayas, the monarch of mountains, whose roots run into the very heart of the earth, and whose proud head pierces the blue vaults of the empyrean, of valor and prowess like unto the Almighty, of sweet presence and charming, even as the queen of night, this displayer of darkness, terrible in his wrath and all-consuming, not unlike the fire that destroys the worlds at the close of the great day, but withal patient and enduring, even as Mother Earth, a great giver, even as Kubera, the Lord of Wealth. He is truth and justice, in human mold as it were. And Dashratha, the Lord of Men, yielding to the oft-repeated prayers of his subjects, set his heart upon making over his kingdom to Rama, and along with it the cares of the state. Rama, the living example of every virtue, Rama of irresistible might, Rama, the firstborn of his sons, Rama, fitted by nature and education to be the best and brightest ornament to a throne, Rama, in whose heart the welfare and happiness of his subjects occupies the foremost place. Now Kaikeyi, the best beloved of his wives, viewed with a troubled heart and envious eye the gorgeous preparations that were on foot towards the installation of Rama. Long, long ago, during a fierce battle with the Asuras, she had saved the king's life at the peril of her own, and he, in a transport of gratitude, had allowed her to ask him any boon she would. Now was her time. And she said to the fond king, exile Rama to the forest and crown Bharata in his place. Dashratha never went back upon his word, for was he not the proud descendant of the mighty monarchs of the solar race who cheerfully sacrificed at the altar of truth, wife and child, wealth and kingdom, life and limb? Nay, their very hopes here and hereafter, and deemed themselves happy in being allowed to do so? He sent Rama away to the wild forest and with him his own life and happiness, for Rama was the joy of his old age and pride of his heart. But Rama, the brightest example of filial reverence, whom alone and unaided the world's hosts embattled dare not face, cheerfully gave up the crown that was his by right and betook himself to the forest out of deference to his father's wishes and out of a desire to gladden the heart of his stepmother Kaiki. Had they not his word for it? And Lakshmana, the favorite brother of Rama, cheerfully accompanied him to the woods, setting to all the world a rare example of fraternal affection. He was ever a source of joy to his worthy mother, Sumitra, who sent him after Rama with the memorable words, "Henceforth Rama is unto you a father, and Sita your loving mother. The pathless woods are your royal home in Ayodhya, and may all good go with you." As the star Rohini ever follows her husband, the moon, even so did Sita accompany her husband to the wild woods. Of Janaka's royal race she came, and was the fairest and the best of the daughters of the earth. Dearer unto her lord than his very life, she lived in him and but for him. For was she not his own energy, come down on earth to aid him in his great work? The sad king and his sadder subjects followed him a long way. At Sringavera, on the banks of the river Ganga, Rama came upon a dear friend of his, Guha, the king of the wild foresters, and bade his charioteer Sumitra go back to his father. Then, guided by him, they traveled over many a trackless forest and forded many a foaming torrent until they halted at the hermitage of the sage Bharadwaj, who directed them further on to Chitrakuta's hill. There, the brothers built for themselves a charming cottage and led a calm and peaceful life in the pleasant woods, happy even as are the gods and the Gandharvas. Meanwhile, the unhappy father, stricken even unto death at being parted from the son of his heart, passed away in an agony of grief, calling upon his darling Rama, and took his place in the mansions of the blessed. Thereupon, Vasishtha and the other counselors of Dashratha tried their very best to induce Bharata to accept the vacant throne. But he, mighty of arms and with his heart ever devoted to Rama, would not even hear of it. He was on his way to the royal exile to beg him to come back and rule over his people. Soon he came upon the high-souled Rama in his forest home, and to him of irresistible valor thus spoke Bharata in all humility and reverence. "Now that our father is no more, yours is the crown, yours is the kingdom, and who knows better than yourself that a younger brother has no claim to the throne before his elder, best fitted to adorn it? Come back and be the king over us." Thus spoke he, but all in vain, for the other felt happier among the woods and streams, and chose the path his fathers trod before him, the path of honor and fame. The kingdom was his by right and by might, but he had given his word to his royal father, and was he the man to go back upon it? Gently but firmly he persuaded Bharata to go back to Ayodhya, but at his earnest prayer gave him his sandals, thrice holy with a touch of his feet, visible representatives of the rightful king and the invisible source of Bharata's wise government and welfare of his kingdom. Had not the world a glimpse of the greatness in the matter of Ahalya? "Twice 7 years hence will I meet you here, doubt not," were the words that fell upon the ears of the disappointed Bharata as he wended his sorrowful way back, not to Ayodhya, to Nandigrama, from where, as regent of the royal sandals, he looked after the affairs of the kingdom, living the life of a hermit, his heart with Rama, and his eyes ever turned along the road that should bring back his brother to him. Then it occurred to Rama that at Chitrakuta he was easily accessible to his friends and subjects, so he resolved to penetrate into the heart of the wild Dandaka forest. True, it was a rough life and utterly unmate for such as were brought up in the lap of royal luxury and ease, but what was it to him? Was not his word gone forth? Were not his mind and senses under perfect control? He never lacked anything in his royal palace at Ayodhya or in the rough ways of the forest. So with his faculties all on alert, he plunged into the depths of the interminable woods, and his eyes acquired a new light and charm at the prospect of approaching battle with dread Rakshasas. First and foremost of those that fell by his hand was the fierce Rakshasa Viradha. Thereupon the world-honored paid his lowly respects to Sharbhanga, Sutikshna, Agastya and his brother, and from Agastya he received with a glad heart the mighty bow left with him by Indra, a goodly sword and two quivers that bore an inexhaustible supply of arrows. And unto Rama, who passed his days in the sweet company of the holy sages, came countless ascetics that had made Dandaka their home. Of fiery energy were they and radiant in the spiritual glory, but withal they prayed him to free them from the terrors and persecutions of the fierce Rakshasas and the lawless Asuras that infested the dark depths of Dandaka. Thereupon Rama gave them his plighted word to root out the wicked ones slowly but surely whenever a favorable chance should offer itself. And so it came to pass that a Rakshasi, Shurpanakha by name, came upon him in his lowly abode and went away mutilated and disgraced. Janasthan was her home, and she could by her powers of illusion take any form she chose. Fired there too by the sight of their sister thus disfigured and insulted, and more so by her sharp taunts, her brothers Kara, Dushan and Trishnas, along with them, rushed at Rama and hemmed him round with their fierce hosts. But of the 14,000 terrible Rakshasas that marched forth to battle that woeful day, only one survived to tell that tale. One and all, they lean low on the field of death, dispatched to the mansions of the blessed by the fiery arrows of the solitary warrior. It was not long before the news reached Ravana, who beside himself with rage at the total annihilation of his kinsmen and at the insults put upon him, besought the assistance of Maricha in aiding him to accomplish his fiendish scheme of revenge. Long and earnestly did Maricha seek to dissuade him from his fell purpose. Knowest thou not thou art but a grain of dust before that Supreme One? Draw not, my lord, upon thy head the wrath of such as he. But Ravana, driven thereto by resistless fate, spurned aside the well-meant advice of his uncle and forced Maricha on pain of death to accompany him to the hermitage of the royal exiles. There Ravana used his friend to decoy the brothers far, far off from their cottage, and in their absence made away with the spouse of Rama, the beloved darling of Rama, and conveyed her to his island home in Lanka, wounding unto death Jatayu, the vulture king, who defended her with the last drop of his blood. The brothers came back soon enough and found that their house was left unto them desolate, for Sita was not there. After a while they came upon Jatayu, who would not yield up his life before he had acquainted Rama with the cruel outrage done to him. Then mighty grief overcame Rama, and like unto one who had taken leave of his senses, he filled the woods around with the heart-rending cries and piteous lamentations. But mastering himself with a supreme effort, he consigned to the flames the mortal remains of the valiant Jatayu, faithful unto death, and plunged into deep woods in search of Sita. By and by they fell in with the fierce Rakshasa Kabanda by name, hideously deformed and frightful to behold. Him, Rama slew and his vast bulk threw into the fire, and the demon, purified of his sins by the touch of the Supreme Lord, resumed his place among the Gandharvas. But ere his departure, he informed Rama of the woman ascetic that lived not far off, Shabari by name, well versed in the mysteries of Dharma and a worthy exponent thereof. "Go unto her, my lord," prayed Kabanda, and unto her hermitage Rama took his weary way. He had come down on earth to destroy the evil forces that barred the path of his devotees to his feet, and radiant looked he in the pride of his youth and might. Warm welcome did Shabari extend unto Rama, and directed by her he reached the shores of Lake Pampa. There he fell in with Hanuman, a monkey, who introduced him to his master Sugriva. And Rama related unto him all his griefs and all his misfortunes, whereat Sugriva's heart was glad in that heaven sent him a companion in misery whose valor and prowess seemed irresistible. The two swore eternal friendship and faithful, while the god of fire bore witness to it. "How did this come about?" asked Rama of his newly made friend. "The blood feud between you and your brother?" And Sugriva acquainted him with the sad story. "Now will I slay that brother of thine, even Vali," cried Rama, and he swore it by a mighty oath. Then Sugriva spoke to him of the unparalleled strength of Vali and his fierce valor, the strength of the gods and men, asuras and rakshasas, and half in jest he cast his eyes upon a huge skeleton that lay hard by and said, "This was once Dundubi the asura, and Vali kicked it here from Kishkinda, where he slew the braggart." A curious smile played upon the features of Rama, a smile of pity at Sugriva's distrust of his might, and at the trivial task set upon him to test it, and he gave it a light kick with his right toe that sent it flying 10 yojanas off. Then, to make his assurance doubly sure, he loosened a shaft from his bow that cleft 7 towering salt trees, pierced through a mountain nearby, and stayed not its course until it ran through the 7 nether regions beneath the earth and came back to its master. Sugriva doubted no more. His eyes were opened and his spirits rose, and with a light heart and a joyful mien, he took his way to Kishkinda cave and the princess along with him. Stationing himself before it, he gave forth from his broad and tawny chest a leonine roar that shook the hills around. Thereat, Vali rushed out in mad fury, but was stayed by his wife Tara, whose fears he managed to allay. And in the fierce battle that ensued, Rama's arrows cleft his mighty heart in twain. Thus did Rama fulfill his promises to Sugriva and seat the weary exile on his brother's throne. In hot haste did Sugriva send for all monkeys under the sun and for their chiefs, and dispatched them to north, south, east, and west directions in search of Mother Sita. Of those that proceeded south was Hanuman, the pride and glory of his race. He heard from Sampati, the vulture, that Sita was in Lanka, held there in durance vile by the infamous Ravana, and with a tremendous leap he vaulted sheer over 100 yojanas of roaring waters that lay between. Landing on the sea-girt isle where the dread Ravana held his royal sway, he came upon Sita in Ashoka Grove, her heart far away over the wide waters and with her lord. With her he had speech and showed unto her his credentials, the ring given to him by her lord. He related unto her all that befall Rama. Meanwhile, "Grieve not, noble lady," he exclaimed. "Your lord spares no pains to come to you. Soon, sooner than you think, will you see him here." And half in sport, he shattered to pieces the huge ornamental gateway of that vast pleasure garden. There it came against him five mighty captains of hosts, and close upon their heels seven sons of counselors, whom he made short work of. Then Aksha, the valiant son of Ravan, whom he reduced to a shapeless mass, and in the end allowed himself to be bound by the Brahmastra of Indrajit. Thanks to the boon conferred upon him by the lotus-born Varun, Brahma, he freed himself therefrom, but desirous to see Ravana face to face and have speech with him, he chose to appear as if still in bonds and calmly put up with the insults of his captors, who dragged him in triumph before their lord. His ruse was successful. He had the pleasure of bearding the lion in his den and failed not to give him a piece of his mind, and that freely. He then burnt the town with hostile flame. All except where Sita sat, and flew back on the wings of speed to carry the welcome tidings to the expectant ears of his master. Soon stood he before the high-souled one, went around him reverently, and cried out, "Drishta, Sita, found! Those eyes were erstwhile blessed with the sight of my mother, Sita." The princes lost no time in reaching the shores of the dark ocean, and along with them Sugriva and his countless hosts. Rama called upon the Lord of the Waters to come unto him, but he came not, whereat he was wrought, and with his shafts bright and fierce as the noonday sun, he shook the mighty ocean to its very depths. Then the heart of the monarch of the deep quaked within him, and he laid his head at the feet of Rama and implored pardon. And at his advice, Rama caused the monkey chief Nala to lay a bridge across the fathomless waters. Over it they lay to the island home of Ravana, and him did Rama slay in dire battle. Now was Sita once more his own, but sad was his heart, and melancholy held him back. For has she not dwelt with the Rakshasa ever so many months? Would not the cruel world point its finger of scorn at him and cry, "Lo, he has taken her back unto him," and the wild Ravana laid his unclean hands on her and had her with him long enough? So he spoke to her seemingly bitter words and sharp in the hearing of the assembled hosts, and cut to the heart. Sita, chaste as chastity and pure as driven snow, brooked it not, but consigned her fair body unto the affrighted flames. The god of fire bore her back in hot haste, and swore her spotless and unsullied by all he held sacred. Gladness filled the heart of Rama, and his face shone bright. The three worlds rejoiced thereat, animate and inanimate, men and the gods, saints and sages, and lauded to the skies the glorious deed of Rama. Vibhishana, the brother of Ravana, was crowned king of Lanka in his place, and his stupendous work accomplished, Rama's heart was relieved of a load of anxiety and danced with joy. The gods, one and all, showered their choicest boons upon him, and through which he raised to life his faithful monkeys that fell in battle. Then with his friends and followers did he turn his face up towards Ayodhya, and was conveyed thereto in the swift-coursing Pushpaka, the magic air-car of Kubera. Making a halt at the hermitage of the holy Bharadwaja, he sent Hanuman before him to announce his return to his brother Bharata. After a while he resumed his journey, and beguiling the way by recounting his adventures in the wild woods, soon reached Nandigrama. There the brothers put away the matted locks and lowly habiliments of recluses, and Rama, pure and stainless, welcomed Sita to his heart and took his place upon his father's throne. Under his benign rule, the people were rich in flocks and herds. Their home resounded with the joyous laughter of happy children. Famine and disease were strangers to the land. Each order of society goes through its round of duties cheerfully and lacks not the means to do it. Their lives know no calamity, public or private. No one suffers the pangs of hunger, nor eats his heart out with grief. His subjects are rich in all the joy that boundless wealth can give, and are blessed with perfect health and sweet content. No father is doomed to see his son die before his eyes. Wives never outlive their husbands, nor suffer the cruel shame of widowhood, but pass their days in loving service to their lords. His subjects were immune from all perils through wind or wave, fire or fever. Thieves and robbers, hungers and want, are things unknown during the rule of Rama. Town and hamlet, village and city, are amply rich in corn and wealth, and all are as happy and content as in the Krita Yuga, the golden age of the world. Horse sacrifice without number will he perform, at which he will give away to Brahmanas vast quantities of gold and gems and countless heads of cattle. Hundreds and thousands of royal houses will be found, such as Kamarupa, Kanyakubja, and others, too numerous to mention. He will see that the four orders of society are secure in their rights and privileges and discharge their duties to the very best. The years of Rama's reign on earth are 10,110, that is 11,000. And then in the fullness of time will he go back to his seat in the highest of all planets. This record of Rama's life purifies the hearts of men, destroys their sins, and confers supreme merit. Hence the wise hold it in equal reverence with the Vedas, and he who reads it with a devout heart is freed from sin of every kind. A long and happy life is his portion in the world of men. And when he goes away from it, he is a welcome guest in the highest of the planets, and is held in great honor amongst them, his kith and kin. Should a Brahmana read it, gift of speech is his meed, and wisdom unequaled. Should one of the warrior race read it, the wide earth and all it contains owns his sway. Should a Vaishya read it, merchant princes pay homage to him. Nay, should a Shudra happen to hear it, he shall win honor and glory amongst his kind. Mangalam Koshilendraya Mahaniya Gunapte Chakravarti Dhanurjaya Sarva Bhaumaya Mangalam.